It is Monday, July 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump says he discussed the 2016 election meddling with Russian President Vladimir Putin at the summit in Helsinki. Turkey marks the second anniversary of the attempted coup against President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and U.S. farmers brace for the long-term impact of the escalating trade war. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump says he spent a great deal of time addressing Russian meddling in the U.S. election during talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, but he didn't directly criticize his Russian counterpart over the issue.
During today's meeting, I addressed directly with President Putin the issue of Russian interference in our elections. I felt this was a message best delivered in person. Spent a great deal of time talking about it.
Trump spoke to reporters during a joint news conference with the Russian leader. U.S. intelligence agencies have concluded Russia meddled in the 2016 election, but Putin, in his remarks Monday, said the Russian state never interfered and does not plan to interfere in internal American electoral process. When asked who he believes on the issue of election meddling, Trump said he has great confidence in U.S. intelligence agencies, but also noted Putin was extremely strong in his denial. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman was at the news conference in Helsinki and tells me what occurred.
Sarah, this was certainly a remarkable news conference. It'll probably end up being historical. Whether that will be something in the history books that will be good for the Trump presidency or not, it is way too early to tell because of the ongoing investigation being conducted by the special counsel. And that was referenced numerous times, including the issue of these 12 Russian intelligence officers that were indicted last week. And President Putin addressed that also, saying he would look into it, said they're alleged intelligence officers, and he invited Special Counsel Mueller to send his investigators to Russia. He said they can also make an official request for extradition. President Trump, of course, on the defensive on this issue, saying that he saw no reason to believe that Moscow had hacked into the election and helped him win, saying that the Russian president was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today. And in fact, on a number of issues, the president did note that he raised a number of matters, including Ukraine and Syria. But in all of these cases, he really did not offer a criticism of anything that Russia has been doing. And that is certain to be noted.
Trump spoke quite a bit about the election, and he kept repeating that he had won. He clearly had won. And he talked a lot about his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton's, talking again about her email servers. He kept talking about that.
Sure. Very much an extension of what he's been saying for weeks, trying to put the focus on the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton's campaign and issues involving their computer servers. And really, this has been something that the president has done time and time again to sort of change the narrative on this. But I think what is really notable is the fact that the president was essentially disagreeing with the conclusion of all of the major U.S. intelligence agencies and flying in the face of the indictments that the Russians were up to no good in the 2016 election. So I would think that Vladimir Putin has to be very pleased with the performance by Donald Trump here today.
Putin was also asked by a reporter about whether the two leaders had talked about Russia's annexation of Crimea. The reporter also asked about any potential compromising information that the Russian government might have about Trump. And Putin responded to both of those.
Sure. I saw him cracking more than a little smile when that question was raised. And Putin did go into a bit of a humorous vein in his response on that, saying that he was an intelligence officer and he does know how dossiers can be made up. He said, as far as, you know, anything involving the president being compromised or his campaign being involved in collusion with the Russians. Quote, the final say is for the courts to deliver. But specifically concerning this dossier and the most salacious material involving a trip by Donald Trump when he was a businessman, President Putin basically said that Trump was not under surveillance when he visited Russia, that there was no reason to surveil, and would we really think that they would be spying on every single American businessman who comes to Russia, and that was utter nonsense to imagine. Although he didn't turn to President Trump and saying, you know, we don't have any such dirt on you. But the president himself, President Trump, responded saying he believes that if there was any truth to that, that such information would have come out a long time ago. So a very fascinating and newsworthy encounter between these two presidents standing at the podiums discussing this issue, which has been consuming American politics now for many, many months.
Yeah, the two leaders indicated they want to meet more often or more regularly.
Yes, I think that was something that President Putin emphasized a number of times during this news conference here, and that he is looking for better cooperation. There is that issue of the sanctions that the United States has on Russia. And while that wasn't addressed at the news conference, Putin said that it's clear that business people in both the United States and Russia want better economic cooperation. And he's proposing a dialogue involving all people from all different types of professions from the United States and Russia to get together. And Putin also emphasized cooperation in counterterrorism and cybersecurity, saying that he wants to see more of that. And there was some discussion about the issues in Syria. And both Putin and Trump said that their two militaries are cooperating there, but it is a complex issue, and that they both agreed on providing security for Israel. But President Trump also said that he believes that U.S. and Russian cooperation in Syria, quote, could save hundreds of thousands of lives. So these aren't issues that are going to go away today. They're both talking about having more meetings between themselves. So I think we can definitely say, from the position, as Donald Trump put it, where he had characterized until today the relations between Moscow and Washington being at their worst state ever, he said that that changed as of 4 hours ago.
VOA White House correspondent Steve Herman in Helsinki. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. The United States says to its allies that Washington will consider case-by-case waivers on sanctions against Iran. A jailed Reuters reporter pleads his innocence in a court in that country. A New York Times report says the White House seeks direct talks with the Taliban. And former Pakistan Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and his family file legal appeals. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Despite an outcry from animal rights activists, a number of consumer product manufacturers still rely on animal testing to determine if their goods are safe for people to use. Scientists at Johns Hopkins University say, in a new study, new and advanced algorithms that draw on information from large chemical databases can more accurately predict chemical toxicity than animal tests. Thomas Hartung, the study's principal investigator and director of the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing at Johns Hopkins, calls his team's research findings a real eye-opener. He says the results suggest that this computer and database system could not only replace animal testing, but would also provide more reliable results. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Italy allows ships with hundreds of migrants to dock in Sicily. Sunday marked the second anniversary of the attempted coup in Turkey to overthrow the government of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The coup left nearly 250 people dead. Since then, Turkey has been under a recurring state of emergency, and tens of thousands have been detained, while tens of thousands of civil servants have lost their jobs for their purported links to terrorists. Mr. Erdogan has repeatedly blamed a network of supporters of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen for being behind the failed coup. The U.S. Sunday called the attempted overthrow heinous, an attack on democracy, and reaffirmed its support of Turkey and its democratic institutions. James Jeffrey, a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Affairs, is a former American diplomat posted to Turkey. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty that while there was plenty of skepticism early on, it turns out there is no other explanation than that the Gulenist movement carried out the failed coup.
People need to think a little bit about that, because there was a lot of feeling of, well, maybe if, you know, whatever Erdogan says has to be wrong. If he says the sun rises in the east, take a look at the west. And we saw a lot of this, and it really hurt the relationship with the United States. Now, fortunately, the Trump administration has issued a very nice statement out of the State Department commending the Turkish people for putting down, which was a coup against a democratically elected government and a very violent one, 250 people killed. And so slowly but surely, we're trying to recover from what I think was a really big mistake.
President Erdogan said, marking the second anniversary, Turkey has, quote, cut off the arms of the octopus, a reference to the Gulen organization. What happens to this Muslim cleric who's now exiled in Pennsylvania?
Well, there's an extradition case out against him under a 1981 or 82 extradition treaty between the United States and Turkey. Extradition cases, particularly when they involve political circumstances, even if the crime is clear, and the crime included trying to kill a head of state, that makes it a complicated issue for the U.S. government to work their way through all of the evidence. In particular, it's not enough to prove that the Gulenist movement was behind the coup. You have to prove that Fethullah Gulen, the head of the organization, who's in Pennsylvania, actually knew about it and audited it. And there is a debate right now on whether enough evidence has been produced yet to make this a likely victory in a U.S. court, because a magistrate has to decide and the U.S. government has to argue the case for Turkey, and we're not there yet.
What does this do to U.S.-Turkey relations?
There are other issues, including the jailing of an American, Pasen Bunsen, in Izmir, several other criminal cases either in the United States or in Turkey that are quite controversial, and differences, although they're being resolved, I think, in northern Syria between the U.S. and Turkey in our two zones and with our various local allies. But as I said, those are being resolved. The main other problem right now is the sale of S-400 Russian missiles to Turkey, and the problems that creates for our own F-35 fighter program, because Turkey is a major purchaser of it and a major participant in the program.
James Jeffrey says despite a number of serious bilateral issues, the Trump administration has put a lot of effort into improving ties with Ankara. And the cleric's denials of involvement in the failed coup notwithstanding, Jeffrey said his 40 years' experience in the region informs him it is hard to imagine how the Gulenist network could launch such a serious effort without his knowledge. Hundreds of migrants aboard two border patrol ships were allowed to disembark in the Sicilian port of Pozzallo early Monday after a half dozen European countries promised to take in some of them rather than have Italy process their asylum claims alone. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
After 2 days at sea and a very long night, the 450 migrants aboard the Italian ship Monte Sperone and the British naval vessel Protector were finally allowed to disembark at dawn. They had been picked up from an overcrowded boat that left Libya on Friday. Among them were 128 unaccompanied minors. The ships, one operated by EU border agency Frontex and the other by Italy's tax police, were given permission to bring the mainly Eritrean and Somali migrants into port only after other European Union countries agreed to accept more than half of them, ending a diplomatic standoff that had left them stuck at sea.
Non penso che questi immigrati siano in grado di essere spostati.
Roberto Ammatuna, the mayor of Pozzallo, said he does not expect that the migrants can be moved for a few days. He said many are suffering from scabies and that there are many minors. He said it may be necessary to wait a few more days before they are transferred to other European countries or other holding centres in Italy. As the migrants disembarked, at least 8 suspected people smugglers were driven away in police cars. The office of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said, "Today we can say that for the first time, migrants are landing in Europe, after France, Malta, Germany, Spain and Portugal each agreed to take in 50 of the 450 migrants who landed at Pozzallo." Interior Minister Matteo Salvini, who initially closed Italy's ports to the migrants, said Italy is no longer Europe's refugee camp. It is a political victory, adding that firmness and consistency pay off. He stressed the need for Libya to be recognized as a safe port for migrants.
Quello che porremo come questione in sede europea è...
Speaking in Moscow, where he attended the World Cup soccer final, Salvini said Italy would discuss with its European partners the need to legitimately rescue, save and assist everyone, but then to take them back to where they left from. The European Commission said it shared the sense of urgency, voiced in a letter on migrants from Prime Minister Conte to European Council President Donald Tusk and Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. The Commission also welcomed the 6 EU member states that have decided to take in some of the migrants. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. U.S. farmers are already beginning to feel the effects of tariffs imposed by China and retaliation for U.S. tariffs on Chinese steel and aluminum. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, while the short-term concern for farmers is the impact on profits this year, the bigger worry is the longer-term consequences of the escalating trade dispute.
As Brian Duncan,
it'll bring it on,
prepares for a summer harvest of the picturesque amber waves of grain growing on his Polo, Illinois farm, his current situation is far from the American dream.
We're in trouble. It's dry.
Wheat is just one product that grows on Duncan's farm, which also produces 70,000 hogs each year.
Hogs were projected to be profitable this year.
Were, but not anymore.
Once that tariff went on, the pork stopped going into China, not going to Taiwan either, not finding other routes. It just, that market disappeared. Economists at leading universities have now taken us from a $4 to $5 a head profit to a $7 to $8 a head loss just based on China and some of these periphery issues that's dampened demand.
For most hog farmers, exports are key to profits, and the lack of competitive access to international markets could spell financial hardship, especially for independent pork producers like Duncan.
Listen, the reality is 95% of the world's population is outside these borders, right? We need them as markets, as trading partners.
As the trade dispute continues, Duncan, who also serves as vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, is losing money on virtually everything growing on his farm. due to imposed or impending tariffs. What he's left with is mounting frustration.
This was preventable. This was predictable, the outcome. There was a better way to go about this.
Tariffs are kind of a last resort for a really specific instance and a really serious bridge or breach of a contract, and not just something that you would lob out there to try to make progress in a trade agreement. And I think that's what's surprised farmers a bit.
Tamara Nelson, Senior Director of Commodities with the Illinois Farm Bureau, says if history is a guide, the loss of market access for U.S. products will have long-term implications.
In every event, we lost a market share or we encouraged production somewhere else of that same product, and it took U.S. agriculture, 20, 30 years to get some of those markets back. In some cases, we haven't fully gotten the markets back.
The tariffs come at a difficult time for farmers.
We've seen farm income cut in half in the last 4 years for various reasons. We could easily see it cut in half again if we lose all our export markets.
Which Duncan says could increase dependence on government aid at a time when lawmakers in Washington debate a new farm bill that the agriculture industry needs to provide security. The uncertainty has Duncan evaluating his options the next time he heads to the ballot box.
It's the economy, stupid. My vote will depend an awful lot on the farm economy. That's just the world I live in.
A world that is now more connected and dependent on international trade than ever before. Kane Faerbaugh, VOA News, Polo, Illinois.
Thank you, Kane, and that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said the Iranian regime's response to protests in Iran shows the country's leadership is running scared.
Thousands have been jailed arbitrarily, and at least dozens have been killed. As seen from the hijab protests, the brutal men of the regime seem to be particularly terrified by Iranian women who are demanding their rights.
Recent events appear to confirm this view. State television broadcast a video of a young teenage girl being interrogated, presumably by an official. The girl is tearfully admitting to breaking moral norms for posting clips of herself on Instagram dancing. Dozens of women have been arrested in the last few months for peacefully protesting against the compulsory hijab. One such protester, Shaparak Shajarizadeh, reportedly was sentenced to 20 years in prison. In a video posted online on July 9th, she said she has left Iran to escape such injustice. Ms. Shajarizadeh's lawyer, Nazreen Sotoudeh, who defended her and others peacefully protesting the compulsory hijab, called such arrests a manifestation of violence against women. In June, Sotoudeh herself was arrested and taken to Evin prison to serve out a 5-year sentence for crimes which, at the time of her arrest, were not disclosed. Another prominent female human rights defender and lawyer, Zainab Tohari, was also detained in June and charged with spurious crimes like disturbing public opinion and spreading propaganda against the system for publicly expressing her opinion that her client, who had been hastily executed, did not receive sufficient fair trial guarantees. Iranian women are responding to the regime's brutality with the courage they have shown for years. As one example, in support of the teenage dancer arrested and interrogated by the authorities, many have written messages deploring her treatment or have posted videos of themselves dancing using the hashtag #DancingIsNotACrime. As Secretary of State Pompeo has said, the United States will continue to advocate tirelessly for the Iranian people. The regime must improve how it treats its citizens. It must protect the human rights of every Iranian.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.